I'm Eugene Meyer, President of the Society, and this memorial lecture series started, as many of you know, shortly after 9/11. And Ted Olson's inaugural lecture reminded us of what it means to be an American and how our legal tradition is part of our identity as Americans. That reminder only gets more important every year. We want the lecture series to remind lawyers of it so they foster legal principles that advance individual freedom, personal responsibility, and the rule of law. And I do, with this being the 20th anniversary, I want to give the other lecturers who've included Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts, Vice President Cheney, Judges Ken Starr, Robert Bork, Ray Randolph, Edith Jones, Doug Ginsburg, Dennis Jacobs, Jeff Sutton, and then Judge, now Justice Neil Gorsuch, former Attorney Generals Bill Barr and Michael Mukasey, former White House Counsel Don McGahn, Peter Thiel, John Allison, and Senators Tom Cotton and Ben Sasse. Quite a group. Anyway, brings us to today's lecture, which could not be more appropriate. The series has been remarkably successful for 20 years. And for years before that, Ted and Barbara hosted a summer barbecue at their beautiful house for our student chapter presidents, which drew hundreds of prominent attorneys in addition to those students, and helped encourage those chapter presidents to build our chapters, and through that, build the society and encourage many more to be involved. I'm sure some of those chapter presidents are probably in the audience today. And then there's also Ted's strong and consistent defense of free speech, including repeatedly explaining to reporters who are doing national stories on the Federal Society that the Federal Society, unlike, say, the American Bar Association, never told Ted what to think. I could give you a lot of Ted's bio, but I think what we want to do is hear from Ted. I simply want to say you've done a great deal for us, Ted, and having this lecture in Barbara's honor has been a highlight. We are so honored to have you deliver the 20th annual Barbara Olson Lecture. Ted?
Thank you. Thank you. The long as you keep that up, it'll be that much longer before the cocktail party. Well, it's a great, great privilege to be a part of the Federal Society and to be participating in the Barbara Olson traditional lecture. On a clear and sunny September 11, 20 years ago, the world we had been living crumbled and time seemed to come to a stop. Unlike December 7, 1941, when the full force of Japan's Air Force launched a surprise attack on a faraway Navy base. This time, a mere 19 individual zealots, armed with hate and with little more than box cutters, executed a massive, coordinated, and crippling attack on our people, our government, and our institutions. They exploded, hijacked commercial airliners packed with civilian passengers into America's commercial base in New York City and the nerve center of our defense establishment at the Pentagon a few miles from here. Had it not been for the towering heroics of a few brave passengers, one of their hijacked planes would likely have hit the Capitol and killed hundreds of members of Congress. Thousands of individuals on those flights and occupying those structures were murdered, maimed, and horribly burned that day. New York's Commercial Center and the command center of our national defense were reduced in a single morning to smoking rubble. Wrenched abruptly from our complacent, comfortable bubbles, we came face to face that day with a vulnerable, fragile, and defenseless future, not from an attack by a warring nation, but from a tiny collection of determined fanatics. The gut punch reality was hard to accept, but we had to. The world was populated by thousands more like them, similarly motivated and equally capable of horrible devastations, with nothing to lose. One of our own, Federalist Barbara Brasher Olson, was one of the victims that day as she headed for Los Angeles on American Airlines Flight 77. Terrorists could not have selected a more quintessential American victim. She was a Texan Catholic who had put herself through a predominantly Jewish law school in the heart of New York City. She declined a lucrative job at a prominent New York law firm to come to Washington in order to fulfill her longstanding ambition to be at the center of the nation's political world. The Federalist Society was a dream come true for Barbara. She loved the rough and tumble of robust debate, bursting with ideas, energy, passion, and enthusiasm. She persuaded the dean of her persuasively liberal law school to allow her to form the first Federalist Society chapter at Cardozo Law School. And immediately after law school, she thrust herself into Washington life, becoming in rapid succession a lawyer in private practice, an assistant United States attorney, a top congressional investigator, Deputy Solicitor General of the House of Representatives, General Counsel for the Senate Whip, author of two best-selling books about the Clintons, not favorable, I must say, and a regular and remarkably successful political and legal commentator on national television. Barbara saw in the Federalist Society a reflection of herself. She was a passionate believer in individual liberty, private enterprise, and limited government. She had an insatiable appetite for ideas, debate, and intellectual jousting. Barbara enjoyed mixing it up on virtually any subject, and she was very, very good at it. She was outspoken, articulate, and it must be said, brash. She could and would take on anyone in any venue on any issue with little or no advance notice. She was quick and had a rapier-like wit. I told her once that some people thought she was opinionated. She thought that was a great compliment. Of course she had opinions. She had very little time for anyone who didn't have opinions. But she debated with passion, not anger, never mean-spirited or unkind. She delivered her thrusts with a flip of her long blonde hair and a mischievous and contagiously radiant smile. Her adversaries liked and respected her, but feared her at the same time. Barbara was a fighter until the very moment when the terrorists extinguished her life. She somehow managed to reach out to me by phone from her doomed flight as it was being hijacked. Knowing because I told her I had to, that two other hijacked planes had been flown into the World Trade Center towers in New York, she sought in those last moments advice as to how she could save herself and her fellow passengers. Had she been on that plane in Pennsylvania, I believe with all my heart that she would have joined those brave souls who gave their lives to take that plane down rather than letting it continue to fly into the heart of Washington. Barbara loved being a part of the Federalist Society. The debates, the people, your energy, your principles, and of course your convictions. You populated and enlivened the world of ideas and placed your opinions, arguments, and contentions on the line. As Jean said, Barbara co-hosted with me summer gatherings of student Federalists in our backyards every year. Indeed, the concept was originally her idea. We started in 1990 or 91 with a few summer students, Washington lawyers, and a few judges. She sought to create networks and mentorships for young Federalists. I think our first event involved something like 30 people. By the time Barbara was murdered, the crowds had come to exceed 500 in our backyard. And it kept growing and growing until Jean finally put a stop to that and moved the venue to a more common place like the Supreme Court. And in those backyard events for these young students included lawyers and judges and people from Washington, luminaries such as Robert Bork, Clarence Thomas, Nino Scalia, David Sintel, Larry Silverman, Dick Leon, Steve Williams, Doug Ginsburg, Danny Boggs, Spence Abraham, Sam Alito, Chuck Cooper, Paul Clement, Boyden Gray, Lee Lieberman Otis, Ray Randolph, Lillian Bevere, the list goes on and on. I had to stop. But I cannot forget the thrill in your young faces when you came face to face with Bob Bork, or Clarence Thomas, or Nino Scalia. To this day, I encounter lawyers from all over the country, including members of Congress, members of the cabinet, cabinet secretaries, high-level public officials, prominent lawyers who attended those summer parties as young students. They can't wait to tell me what an inspiration that afternoon was for them. Many of you are here tonight. This is just a part of Barbara's legacy. This speech is called the Barbara K. Olson Memorial Lecture. Although I never really cared for that term lecture, it sounds too much like a colonoscopy or any recent speech by President Biden. So I prefer to think of this as a remembrance. So in preparing for this evening, I thought I might try to channel Barbara and what she might think and say about the state of politics and society in America today had her life not been so brutally ended on September 11. I have no doubt that she would have had a lot to say to us, so I will try to limit these imaginary insights to just four subjects. First, America's stature and standing in the world and in the hearts of its people. Barbara liked her fellow Texans, loved this country, and was proud to be an American. She believed in an America that stood tall, was respected by its citizens, allies, and other nations, feared by its enemies, abided by its commitments, and protected the lives and rights of its people. The America that gave birth to the individuals about whom Tom Brokaw coined the term the greatest generation. After 9/11, America came together and demonstrated its unity and resolve and resilience. We proved to one another and to the world that we could not be defeated by terrorism, however horrific and devastating the attack might be. President Bush and Vice President Cheney joined in inspiring the American people to rebuild our transportation industry, our economy, our defenses, and our united spirit. We mobilized our forces to attack Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. We vowed never to forget and never to forgive the brutal savages that sheltered terrorists, spawned terrorism, enslaved and debased their own people, particularly women, and wantonly took the lives and futures of thousands of Americans. Barbara would have been proud of what we as a country accomplished, particularly in Afghanistan, in isolating and punishing the Taliban. She was a fierce advocate for the rights of the oppressed and disadvantaged, helping to form, among other things, the Independent Women's Forum to assist and advance the voices of conservative women in this country so that in future controversies there would be a conservative voice when liberal women came forward to claim to speak for all the women in America. And even as a fledgling attorney, when lawyers at the State Department and the Justice Department were reluctant to do it, she volunteered to go to New York and by herself serve papers on the Palestinian Liberation Organization expelling that terrorist organization from the United States. She was thrilled to do that. Everybody was, said, are you okay? Is it going to be all right? Aren't you afraid? No. So I could only imagine what Barbara would have thought if she had been here to witness the reckless, precipitous, and panic withdrawal of our troops and personnel from Afghanistan this summer, abandoning its people, particularly its women, to the oppression of the Taliban, deserting the people in that country who had helped us hold the Taliban at bay for 20 years, and skulking away from hundreds of American citizens and many thousands of American supporters and friends. She can't speak for herself tonight, but I believe I know what she would have felt when America turned its back on its own citizens, our allies, and those who had fought side by side with us, leaving tens of thousands of people in the hands of the very murderous fanatics who had facilitated her murder. We have learned that our Marines were given a mere 30 minutes to pluck a few people out of thousands of Afghans who had been coming by bus, car, and foot for 10 straight days, assembling near the gates of that airport, standing knee-deep in sewage, attempting to flee from the terror of the Taliban, to whom we had abandoned control of their country. 12 minutes into that desperate half hour, a suicide bomber detonated a device that killed 170 of them and 13 of our own servicemen and women. Thousands of helpless people were deserted and, for the most part, forgotten. What kind of nation does that? Certainly not the America of Douglas MacArthur, George Patton, Dwight Eisenhower, or Ronald Reagan. The America that took on Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, an America that fought for its people and the Bill of Rights, that kept its promises, sent its military after the terrorists, respected and encouraged women and girls to be educated, and stood up to bullies, murderers, thugs, hijackers, and kidnappers. Barbara would have been outraged, incredible, inconsolable that our nation had expended billions of dollars, sent hundreds of our soldiers to their death, and 20 years to defeat groups like Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and ISIS, only to quit, lay down our arms, retreat in panic, and turn Afghanistan over to those very same people who have consistently proclaimed their hatred for America and Israel, and who repeatedly vowed to destroy us. And she would have been astonished when we proclaimed to the world that our forthcoming surrender would be completed in time for September 11. Dishonoring the memory of the nation, of that national tragedy, by capitulating to the same people who had engineered it. What a cruel mockery of the people murdered and crippled on September 11. Phrases like "we will never forget" meant something in Barbara's America. She would have seized at hearing these words uttered in the same breath as speeches bragging about the amazing success of our evacuation, the retrograde, they call it, of our troops, diplomats, and those very few lucky enough not to be left behind. We were told when we announced that we would wash our hands of Afghanistan, that this would not be another Saigon. The Afghan government and its armies would hold off the Taliban for months or more. And when the eminently predictable and sudden collapse did occur, putting the lie to these predictions, we were told that all Americans would be safely evacuated, as well as our supporters. And then, of course, we stampeded out of our airbase in a panic, in the dead of night, without notice to our allies, leaving behind massive amounts of aircraft, vehicles, weapons, uniforms, and ammunition. and we were so rushed to escape from the only remaining barely functioning airport that we left thousands of humans standing in wastewater while issuing talking points about our great success in evacuating the people we did not forget. Again, you heard, we will never forget, we will never forgive. How much accountability has there been for that public, humiliating defeat? None that I have seen. How much are we doing to effect the removal of the remaining abandoned Americans and tens of thousands of terrified Afghans? I haven't heard much about that either. How much longer before the re-energized, rearmed, and diplomatically legitimatized Taliban and the other jihadists grouping in Afghanistan attack America or Israel or Paris or Madrid or churches, synagogues, restaurants, playgrounds, or nightclubs? We hear about our over-the-horizon capacity to stop such terrorism. Does anyone believe that? Second, Barbara would be astonished by our government's unlawful, unilateral relinquishment of our southern border to armies of migrants from all over the world. A central tenet of a nation's sovereignty is the establishment, sanctity, and protection of its borders and its citizens. Ensuring domestic tranquility and providing for the common defense are a nation's obligations, so plain that they are asserted in the preamble to the Constitution and central to our existence as a nation. We seem to have rescinded that cornerstone of sovereignty. Tens, indeed hundreds of thousands of individuals are pouring into the United States, completely undeterred by our national government, in violation of our laws, overriding our ability to make reasoned decisions as to who can come into this country, and threatening the safety and security of all Americans. The invaders include, of course, decent, desperate, sympathetic people seeking asylum and freedom from poverty and corrupt and tyrannical regimes, but also human traffickers, smugglers of addictive poisons such as heroin and fentanyl, fugitives, and unvaccinated carriers of COVID-19 and other afflictions. We don't even seem to be trying to distinguish among them. What other conclusion to draw than that the federal government has intentionally abrogated the principles of American borders and territorial integrity without the consent of the people and our elected representatives? We are being forced to accept and absorb millions of persons of all ages, backgrounds, and motivations without any systematic effort or ability to provide them with the humane integration, education, or opportunity. Our government is now said to be negotiating the size of the bounty we will be paying to some of them. Naturally, they are met with resentment and hostility in many segments of the country because they have flouted our immigration laws with the complicity of our executive. We cannot begin to handle the burdens of this massive invasion creates for our local communities and neighborhoods, so our government either ignores or papers them over with public relations smokescreens and dishonest, evasive pretenses that this is not happening. If the United States cannot or will not control who enters this country, what does this do to our ability to enforce other laws? Indeed, what does that mean for the rule of law in any traditional sense? How can American citizens be expected to respect and obey the law if our federal government sanctions, indeed embraces, even rewards non-citizens who've entered this country in violation of our laws of entry and who acknowledge no responsibility to abide by any or all of our laws? This sounds fairly bleak, doesn't it? But I was trying to figure out what Barbara would say. That leads me to the third dreadful trend that we are witnessing throughout this country that Barbara would have abhorred: the lawlessness permeating and overwhelming our cities. Funding for law enforcement is being reallocated, that is to say, reduced dramatically. And law enforcement officers are retiring or quitting in droves. Increasingly, few sentient individuals are willing to enter a profession offering little beyond personal risks, meager compensation, and daily heapings of disrespect and humiliation. Recently, district attorneys in all parts of the country, including particularly San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Chicago, are refusing to enforce laws or prosecute violators. Arrests are not being made. The criminals who are unlucky enough to be arrested are promptly being released, in New York, for example, to offend again, which they routinely, regularly, and frequently do. Shoplifters, vagrants, and drug addicts, although you can't call them that, swarm streets and harass and intimidate businesses and vulnerable citizens. Stores are closing in the centers of our major cities because businesses cannot stop hordes of thieves from walking brazenly and arrogantly in and out with trash bags or suitcases full of merchandise. Homeless encampments, whose occupants we are now told to refer to as the unhoused, have sprung up everywhere. If you went to Union Station last night, you saw it firsthand. In our streets, sidewalks, parks, underpasses, in subways, bus and railroad terminals, near schools, and even in airports. The streets of San Francisco and other once livable, indeed beautiful cities are littered with needles, garbage, human waste, debris, and open-air drug markets. People are being assaulted, panhandled, badgered, or attacked on the streets, coffee shops, sidewalk restaurants, on buses, subways. Bicycles are being stolen. Car thefts and carjackings are becoming epidemic. Rates of burglaries, assaults, street crime, shootings, rapes, and homicides are steadily increasing. We once used the term third world country to refer to some big city neighborhoods. That has become an insult to the impoverished nations that do not have a fraction of the resources we do. Today, substantial segments of Philadelphia, Baltimore, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and Washington, D.C. merit that description, only worse. How many of you can identify areas in your communities where you would not dare to go after dark, or even in the daylight? And don't answer that question. I know the truth of it. The same local officials who have allowed this to happen with failed, mindless, feel-good policies are endlessly reelected to pursue those same policies. Barbara spent much of her life in Houston, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, D.C. She would today be profoundly depressed to see the decay and disintegration taking hold and strangling these and other cities because of progressive policies of apathy, virtue signaling, and disinterest by elected, for life it seems, political officials. They say they are simply not enforcing small crimes, but when did an offense against our laws or our people become too trivial to enforce? These public figures seemingly don't care about the victims of those crimes, which often can turn out to be very serious. How suddenly civility disappears when civil order disintegrates. Fourth, Barbara was a passionate believer in robust, even fierce debate. She would have been shocked at the cultural, societal shift that has occurred so rapidly in America, not only silencing but oppressing ideas, terms, names, phrases, even holidays, in the name of extinguishing triggers, microaggressions, sensitivities, and imaginary acts of discrimination. Not only must we watch what we say, but how and when we say it, and to whom we are speaking. I'm disregarding my own admonition, of course. Failure to carefully, cautiously calibrate your speech can and will, as they say in the Miranda warning, be used against you. And the banter or silly, immature jokes you exchange in high school can and surely will be deployed to condemn you 20 years later or 40 years later. I recall Barbara's response to a study and report critical of judges and lawyers at a DC Circuit conference a few years ago, castigating acts and words deemed demeaning to women, such as interruptions, insufficiently sensitive questions directed towards women lawyers. Barbara rejected the notion that women couldn't and shouldn't be interrupted during oral arguments or subjected to hostile or otherwise mean questions in court. She did not want, nor did she think, that women should be treated like fragile flowers or delicate china who couldn't take it. Not only did she feel that women, just like men, could handle and prevail in a rough and tumble legal and social environment, but that believing and acting otherwise towards women was demeaning, discriminatory, and led to the view that women, especially women lawyers, were inferior, not tough enough. She hated that. Barbara Olson would have been shocked to see that the woke movement had come so far that even a statue of Thomas Jefferson would be removed from city government in New York, that holidays like Columbus Day and traditional Halloween costumes were either banned or attacked as cultural appropriations. I read just 4 days ago that the Newport News, Virginia School Board had designated the John Marshall Early Learning Center to be given a less odious name in response to a decree from Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, otherwise known only for admitting and denying that the picture of a person in blackface in his college yearbook was him. John Marshall, our longest serving and most acclaimed Chief Justice, too toxic for his name to be on a public school. When a speaker may be banned because of his or her views are unpopular, when street gangs are allowed to intimidate or shoot young children on the way to school, when a person harboring a dog may not be considered an owner, but only a custodian, when a mother has to be referred to as a birthing parent, when the new James Webb telescope faces calls for a new name because NASA Administrator Webb had been an Undersecretary of State 70 years ago in the Truman administration during a congressionally instigated purge on gay persons, when pronouns such as he or she become not only offensive but prohibited if uttered without consent, when those pronouns must become they or them, or when the leader of a decades-old Feast of Lanterns celebrating the first Chinese woman to be born on the Monterey Peninsula must apologize for the parade and issue these words: "The harm I have caused as an unconscious white woman filled with white fragility and my own perfectionism." And when the Federalist Society itself could be castigated because of less than popular views of some of its members. What have we become? Barbara would have seen this as an assault on freedom, the stifling of dissent and unfavored views, and the constitutionalization of conformity, a step on the way to mind control, uniformity, a tyranny against individual liberty, everything that this organization stands for. She would have seen the systemic categorization of decisions, benefits, rights, promotions, and appointments based on race or gender as fundamentally un-American. She bristled when she was told that Texas females should refer to themselves as women, not think of themselves as girls. The more someone tried to intimidate Barbara because of what we now call unwoke speech, the more she would have used it. But I want to leave you on a little lighter note. I must inform you, and I'm happy to inform you, that the New York Times is coming to your rescue. In last Sunday's paper, apparently shocked by the November 2 elections, the Times published a collection of pieces, maybe some of you saw this, with suggestions of how America, as they put it, can snap out of it and revitalize and renew the American spirit. Among their suggestions, and I'm not making this up, you would have been gratified to see were proposals to eliminate citizenship and all age limits on eligibility to vote. All age limits on eligibility. Parents can vote for the newborns. To erase all student, medical, and rental debt, make international law part of the American law, replace the stars and stripes with a monochromal, they have a picture of this, a monochromal gray flag, and, this is the best part, create multiple states from California, Texas, and Florida. There you have it, the simple answer to all of our problems. Expand the franchise to include infants and anyone else who wants to vote. Abolish debt, graywash the American flag, and give California 12 senators. If Barbara were speaking to you this evening, she would have lamented at what we have done to our citizens here and abroad, lawlessness in our communities, the widespread surrender of our national respect and integrity. She would weep, but also rage. She would not be silent. I am certain of that. She would be engaged, fighting, speaking out, organizing, demanding a return of our national integrity and domestic order and safety, and goading those who remain silent in the face of these developments. Of course, she would be encouraged by the involvement of Federalists and like-minded Americans to stand up against these weaknesses, these trends, this disintegration. She would not let us give into apathy, malaise, helplessness, and cravenness, which we are now seeing all around us. So thank you for honoring Barbara with this lecture series and for showing up in such robust numbers for the event every year. Barbara cannot be here physically to participate, but her spirit lurks in the conference rooms and hallways of every Federalist Society meeting.